The passage this morning comes from Luke 15. It's verses 11 through 32 and is the story of the prodigal son. Then he said, "A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me.' So the father divided to them his livelihood. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. But when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And the son would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and even to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him, and he had compassion, and ran and fell onto his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to be merry. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And the servant said to him, 'Your brother has come home, and because your father has received him safe and sound, he has killed the fatted calf.' But the elder was angry and would not go in. Therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, 'Lo, these many years I have been serving with you. I have never transgressed your commandment at any time, and yet you have never given me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you kill the fatted calf for him.' And the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found.'"
So for the next 4 weeks, our text is going to be the parable of the prodigal son, or the parable of the prodigal sons, or the parable of the prodigal family, however you want to call it. And we will look at the parable through a different lens each week. And today, as you can see, the title is "With Dad at the Table and in the Field." With Dad at the Table and in the Field. And I think it's coming. I think it's coming. Can we get the slide on there? It's important that we see the photo that's up there. Great, thank you. So today, the text is a very brief one, and I'm sure you'll be grateful for that. Chapter 15, verse 11. "There was a man who had two sons." That's it. There was a man who had two sons. Now, if we had never known the story and had not heard of the story of the prodigal son, and we heard Jesus or anybody else say that there was a man who had two sons, there would already be enough tension to have a story. There's drama already. All you need is a father and two sons, or a father and two daughters, and you've got drama. We don't need psychology to tell us that. We have the Bible. We have the Bible. Think about all the famous fathers and sons in the world, and even before you know any of the stories, you can just assume there's going to be trouble. Cain and Abel, Ishmael and Isaac, Jacob and Esau, drama in every story. Young David showing up on the battlefront and having his confrontation with his older brother, Eliab, more drama. Absalom and Amnon, the two fighting, feuding sons of David. And then flowing into the New Testament, James and John, the sons of thunder, debating which one is the greatest in the kingdom. And many more famous siblings in the Bible. It seems that whenever you have a father and two sons, you know there's going to be hurt somewhere. And you know that there's going to be the possibility of bloodshed, if not physical, at least emotional. And you know there's going to be the need for an active father stepping in. There's going to need to be forgiveness and grace and reconciliation and redemption and all those wonderful things. In every story, there's drama, and it's because one brother is older and the other brother is younger. In fact, even if you're twins, and you've got twin boys or twin girls, one is older because one came out of the womb first. And it's that word first that is the problematic word. It presupposes that someone has to be second or third or fourth. And the last time I looked, our sin nature generally doesn't like to be second. So what's so great about being first? Let me just ask, how many of you are the oldest sibling in the family? Okay. Oh, my. Well, we've got a lot of very troubled people here. I'll tell you, by the way, my hand's up too. For, you know, my story is there was a man with two sons. And my other married story is that there was a man with two sons. Well, I tell you what's special about being first. You get more history with Dad. You throw the ball more. You hit the puck more times than with your younger brother. You wrestle more with your dad than all your other siblings. Dad has known you and loved you not most, but he has loved you first. No, not more. No, he doesn't love you more. What? Obviously, it was an older brother or sister who answered that way. No. Your dad doesn't love you more. He's just loved you first, and therefore he's loved you longer. So the older brother and the older sister will always struggle with a sense of entitlement, especially after the younger brother or sister comes along. He will need to learn how to share his father and mother's affection and time with all the new babies that come. And the older brother will never want his younger brother to excel beyond him. It's the sin of the older brother. The older brother and the older sister will want to find ways to keep his punk brother just that, his punk brother. Any success or achievement of the younger brother or the younger sister that wins the celebration and applause of others, especially father, will be viewed as a threat to the status of the older brother. And so the older brother's relentless teasing and bullying of the younger brother will be his way of letting the younger brother know just who's boss. Now, the younger brother will naturally love his older brother and hate him all at the same time. It's like a modern miracle. He will want to be like his older brother only until he's smart enough to realize that he will never, ever achieve firstborn status. And so it's a complete waste of time trying and feeling the pain of never quite measuring up. He'll say, nuts to this. I'm out of here. And so the younger brother will be more prone to outright rebellion or the breaking of rules kind of rebellion. He or she will say, what's the use of coloring within the lines if my picture is never going to be as good as my older sibling? So I will color outside of the lines. I will be an abstract painter. And the younger brother will have to find his own unique path. He'll have to create his own successes, his own sense of style. He'll have to develop his own status with the world. And this is important for all parents to know. But sometimes the heroic journey of the second born will lead him or her into the distant country where it appears that all the values given to that child have been for a while rejected. But the younger brother's rebellion will reinforce the older brother's sense of superiority, right? Or what we call in the Bible, righteousness. And herein lies the problem with both brothers. And we see it clearly in this story. They are both seeking their identity, or we would say they are both trying to find themselves independently of their relationship with their father. In fact, when the text says there was a man with two sons, it tells us something very important about the meaning of life. If it started, there was a man with two slaves, or there was a man with two employees, we wouldn't know where the story is going. But when it says there was a man with two sons, we know there's going to be deep pain, and there's going to be a very deep need for redemption, because the words sons are words that define who a person is at the core. They are first a son, first a daughter. And both of the boys in this story don't realize that, at least not yet. The younger son, doubting his true identity as the beloved joint heir with the father, seeks to find his true self in money and what money can buy. And this is evidenced in his demand for the inheritance, even before his father is dead. And what he really wants with the inheritance is he wants freedom from his father. He's tired of living with dad. You see, when you don't really know how much and deeply your dad loves you, you can do without your dad. But the older brother is equally as confused. He is blind, or at least unbelieving, to his father's deep affection for him. And this is evidenced in his angry outburst at his dad when his dad throws a party for the younger brother after his reckless detour. And the older brother shows up and he says, "You've never thrown a party like this for me." I wonder what's going on there. If we go back 5 years before the younger brother takes off with half of the estate, both brothers have been living under the care and the affection and the security and the wealth of their father, but somewhere along the line, both boys believe Lucifer's lie. Of course, Lucifer's lie is that the love and care and protection and goodness of the father is not enough. There's something outside that I need. And the deception that caused our first human family to fall continues on right here in our story. And what we learn is that at its root, sin is relational. It's primarily not a breaking of the rules. It's not going and squandering money on prostitutes in the distant land. Oh, yes, lawlessness will always be the fruit, but at its root, sin is a break in the relationship with dad caused by us not trusting in his love and care for us. Now, because my text is so short, there was a man who had two sons, I am bound to also talk about the only other text in the New Testament that's the exact same text. There was a man who had two sons. And it's another parable of Jesus. in Matthew 21, verses 28 to 32. And it's really, really short, much shorter than the text that we had this morning. So I'll read it to you. It'll just take a minute. Jesus says to the Pharisees, "What do you think? There was a man who had two sons. He went to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in the vineyard.' 'I will not,' he answered, but later changed his mind and he went. Then the father went to the other son and said the same thing, 'Go work in my vineyard.' And he answered, 'I will, sir.' But then he did not go. Then Jesus asked the Pharisees, 'Which of the two did what his father wanted?' 'The first one,' they answered." They answered correctly. Similar to the parable of the prodigal son, the two boys in the parable of the vineyard are different. One of them is a yes man who seems to care more about creating a good first impression with dad than he does about actually following through with his father. The other, like the younger brother in the prodigal son, is at least honest about his disdain of his father and his father's operation. He's not interested in the vineyard. He doesn't want to work with his dad. He's very upfront about that. Neither of the two boys want to work with their father. This is simply another version of the story of the prodigal son. But one brother experiences a conversion, a change of mind, a change of heart. Something happens to him. He's seized by a great affection, as the Puritans used to say. He begins his journey very, very poorly, but he comes under conviction and he arrives late for work. And his dad apparently is delighted to see him. "I'm so glad you're here, son. Thank you for coming. Here, put on this hat. It's hot. Here, put on these gloves. We're pruning today. You start there. I'll start here. And when we meet, we'll have lunch together." It's interesting. Both parables, the setting with father is a place of work. A farm and a vineyard. We would say today the setting takes place in the marketplace. The older brother in the story of the prodigal son is willing to stay on the farm and work, but distant from the father. So he wants the job and he wants the income, but he doesn't want his dad. His relationship with his father and his work on the farm are completely disconnected. We would say today in our relationship with God that there's no continuity between his life at work downtown and his life of faith with God. They're completely separated. Really, the older brother isn't much better than the hired hand. The younger son in the story doesn't want to work on the farm at all. He just wants the money. Give me the money. In fact, both sons, if you look closely, just want the money. Neither of them want their father. And this is why I've chosen this painting. There are probably hundreds of paintings on the prodigal son where the expression on the father's face is one of unparalleled joy that the younger son has come home. And so there should be. The father was overjoyed. But I've chosen this particular painting because the artist wants us to see that though the younger son is home in the embrace of father, there's still another son working out in the field who wants nothing to do with dad. He wants the blessing that dad can give him. He wants the income that comes from the farm, but he wants to keep dad at a distance. And it breaks the father's heart. But what we see in this story is that the work and the money cannot be separated from their relationship with father. I mean, in a way, this story is just like the Garden of Eden, where Adam is still gainfully employed by God, but hiding in the bushes from him. So work is not meant to be done apart from Father. Work is never an end in itself. And in the parable of the vineyard, it's the same way. Neither of the sons want to work. And it's not because they're lazy. Remember, this parable was spoken to Pharisees who are anything but lazy. Why don't they want to work? It's more likely that the son who says he'll work but doesn't opts out from work, not because he's lazy, but because he wants his independence from the father and his father's older brother, Jesus. Ah, the lordship of the older brother over everything. And so he says, yeah, I'll work, but thinks about what that means and says, no thanks. The other son's smart enough to know right off the bat, no thanks. I'm not working because if it means intimacy and submission to you and to him, no. Whatever our particular vocation is, and by that I mean how we spend the majority of our time between breakfast and supper, Monday through Friday, there's an invitation extended to us from our Father and our true older brother, Jesus. And what we've learned from watching Jesus is that though our work is not always exciting, there is a way to work that's intended to not be burdensome, and there's a way to work that is intended for us to fulfill our true created calling. Though work itself can be difficult and stressful and strenuous and underappreciated and underpaying and boring, and you fill in the blank. The one thing that sustains our work and redeems the routine of Monday through Friday is working alongside, with, empowered by the great worker himself. And so work is not an end in itself. It's not simply a means to earn income. It's a partnership with Father and his Son, Jesus, in the power of the Holy Spirit. Employment is a Trinitarian affair. And this is true whether we are a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad, and we know how challenging that can be. It's true whether we are a student or a cabinet maker or a teacher or a truck driver or even a pastor. Our work is the place where we fulfill God's original design for us. To steward the garden, to name the animals, to have dominion over creation, and yes, young moms and young dads, to be fruitful and multiply. But when the work itself and the income earned becomes the dominant focus, everything is turned on its head, everything loses its true meaning and purpose, and we are prone to what some would call burnout, or cynicism, or worse, the idolatry of being driven by money and by success. And so the difference between the hired hand and the son is that the son not only shares in his father's profits, but the son, after work is over, goes home with dad, shares the house with dad, and eats at the same table as dad. With dad, at the table, and in the field. The lordship of father over everything. Now, some of you might be muttering under your breath, "Oh, Brian, this is easy for you to say. You've been off work for 3 months. You've lost your mind." Yeah, in a way, I sort of have. And what a wonderful gift you have given me in these 3 months. But it's given me a lot of time to reflect. In fact, the very first day I was off, apart from thinking about my grandkids who we were taking care of, I thought about work. I thought about work every day of my sabbatical. Not all day, but a little bit every day. I thought about the meaning of work, and I thought about how I work, and most importantly, why I work, and how the Lord might be leading me to work in the next 7 years before my next sabbatical, Lord willing, which would be called retirement. Jesus, who worked for 18 years as a carpenter, probably a stonemason, in the city of Nazareth. We call those the 18 silent years because from the age of 12 to the age of 30, nothing is said about Jesus. All he did is work. Is this not the carpenter's son, they said, when he finally showed up at the age of 30? Jesus is standing here today in the Spirit with the table, with his body and bread, and he is extending this invitation to us. He's inviting us to live a life with him and his Father that begins at the table and then flows out into our day. It starts at the table, and it's lived out in the field, and that it ends in bed. It encompasses every part of our life. If you're anything like me, sometimes what we do between breakfast and dinner can be so all-consuming that we forget that God is with us in our work. This is the thought for the day. And so listen to these familiar words. We started the service with them, and we will end the service with them, only this time I will choose Eugene Peterson's transliteration. Jesus asks, "Are you tired, worn out, burned out? Come to me. Get away with me, and you'll recover your life again. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you will learn how to live freely and lightly." Amen.